This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Becoming Steve Jobs, The Evolution of a Reckless Upstart into a Visionary Leader by Brent Schlender and Rick Tetzeli. Read for you by George Newbern. Author's Note: The reporting and writing of this book is the work of two authors. The two of us have worked together for years, going back to our time together at Fortune magazine. For Becoming Steve Jobs, we spent 3 years researching, interviewing, reporting, writing, and editing together. That said, in the narrative you're about to read, we decided, for convenience's sake, to use the first-person singular throughout to refer to Brent. Brent is the one who had a relationship of almost a quarter century with Steve Jobs. So using the word I made it much easier to tell our story. Prologue. "You're new here, aren't you?" Those were his first words to me. His last, 25 years later, would be, "I'm sorry." Already he had turned the tables on me. After all, I was the reporter, the one who was supposed to be asking the questions. I had been warned about the unique challenges of interviewing Steve Jobs. The night before, over beers, my new colleagues at the San Francisco Bureau of the Wall Street Journal had told me to bring a flak jacket to this first meeting. One of them said, only half-jokingly, that interviewing Jobs was often more combat than questioning. It was April 1986, and Jobs was already a journal legend. Bureau lore had it that he had dressed down another journal reporter by posing this straightforward question: "Do you understand anything at all? Anything at all about what we're discussing?" I'd had plenty of experience with real flak jackets during my years reporting in Central America in the early 1980s. I'd spent much of that time in El Salvador and Nicaragua, where I'd interviewed everyone from truck drivers motoring through war zones to American military advisors in the jungle, to Contra Comandantes in their hideouts, to presidents in their palaces. On other assignments, I'd met with obstreperous billionaires like T. Boone Pickens and H. Ross Perot and Lee Ka-shing, with Nobel Prize winners like Jack Kilby, with rock stars and movie idols, renegade polygamists, and even the grandmothers of would-be assassins. I wasn't easily intimidated. Yet, for the full 20-minute drive from my home in San Mateo, California, to the headquarters of Next Computer in Palo Alto, I brooded and fretted about how best to interview Jobs. Part of my unease came from the fact that, for the first time in my experience as a journalist, I would be calling on a prominent business leader who was younger than I. I was 32 years old. Jobs was 31 and already a global celebrity, hailed, along with Bill Gates, for having invented the personal computer industry. Long before internet mania started churning out wunderkinds of the week, Jobs was technology's original superstar, the real deal with an astounding, substantial record. The circuit boards he and Steve Wozniak had assembled in a garage in Los Altos had spawned a $1 billion company. The personal computer seemed to have unlimited potential, and as the co-founder of Apple Computer, Steve Jobs had been the face of all those possibilities. But then, in September of 1985, he had resigned under pressure, shortly after telling the company's board of directors that he was courting some key Apple employees to join him in a new venture to build computer workstations. The fascinated media had thoroughly dissected his departure, with both Fortune and Newsweek putting the ignominious saga on their covers. In the 6 months since, the details of his new startup had been kept hush-hush, in part because Apple had filed lawsuits trying to prevent Jobs from hiring away its employees. But Apple had finally dropped those suits. And now, according to the publicist from Jobs' PR agency, who called my boss at the Journal, Steve was willing to do a handful of interviews with major business publications. He was ready to start the public fan dance that would begin to reveal in detail what exactly Next was up to. I was thoroughly fascinated and equally wary. I didn't want to get taken in by the notoriously charismatic Mr. Jobs. The drive south to Palo Alto is a trip through the history of Silicon Valley. From Route 92 in San Mateo over to Interstate 280, a bucolic eight-laner skirting San Andreas Lake and Crystal Springs Reservoir, which store drinking water for San Francisco, piped in from the Sierras. Past the blandly ostentatious venture capitalist habitat along Sand Hill Road in Menlo Park, and traversing the oblique, mile-long Stanford Linear Accelerator, which slashes like a hairline fracture through the landscape and beneath the freeway. Past the Stanford Dish Radio Telescope, and the white-faced Herefords and ornate oak trees dotting the expansive greenbelt behind the university campus. The winter and spring rains had resurrected the prairie grass on the hills, turning them briefly as green as a golf course from their usual dull yellow, and peppering them with patches of orange, purple, and yellow wildflowers. I was so new to the Bay Area that I didn't yet realize that this was the most beautiful time of year to make this drive. My exit, Page Mill Road, was the home street address of Hewlett-Packard, early biotech pioneer Alza Corporation, Silicon Valley facilitators like Anderson Consulting, now called Accenture, and the law firm Wilson, Sonsini, Goodrich, and Rosati. But first you hit the university-owned Stanford Research Park, with its groves of low-slung corporate research and development labs, situated with lots of grassy elbow room. Xerox's famed Palo Alto Research Center Park, where Steve first saw a computer with a mouse and a graphical bitmapped screen interface, resides here. This was where he had chosen to headquarter next. A young woman from Next's PR firm, Allison Thomas Associates, escorted me through the boxy two-story concrete and glass office building to a small conference room with a view of a half-filled parking lot and not much more. Steve was waiting there. He greeted me with a nod, dismissed the flack, and before I could get seated, popped that first question. I wasn't sure if Steve wanted a monosyllabic answer or if he was genuinely curious about who I was and where I came from. I assumed the latter, so I started ticking off the places and industries I'd written about for the journal. Right after leaving graduate school at the University of Kansas, I'd moved to Dallas for the paper, where I'd written about aviation, airlines, and electronics, since Texas Instruments and Radio Shack were based there. Along the way, I had won some notoriety for a profile of John Hinckley, the privileged son of a Texas oil man who shot President Reagan in 1981. "What year did you graduate from high school?" he interjected. 1972, I replied. "And I spent 7 years in college but never quite got my master's degree." "That's when I graduated from high school," he interjected. "So we're about the same age." I found out later that he had skipped a grade. I then explained that I'd spent 2 years each in Central America and Hong Kong writing and reporting on geopolitical issues for the journal, and a year in Los Angeles before finally wangling my dream job in San Francisco. At this point, it really was beginning to feel like a job interview, except that Jobs wasn't reacting much to any of my answers. "So, do you know anything about computers?" he asked, interrupting again. "Nobody who writes for the major national publications knows shit about computers," he added, shaking his head with a practiced air of condescension. "The last person who wrote about me for the Wall Street Journal didn't even know the difference between machine memory and a floppy." Now I felt on somewhat firmer footing. "Well, I was an English major, formally, but I programmed some simple games and designed relational databases on a mainframe in college." He rolled his eyes. "For a couple of years, I worked nights as a computer operator processing the daily transactions for four banks on an NCR minicomputer." He was staring out the window now. "And I bought an IBM PC the very first day they were available, at Businessland, in Dallas. Its serial number started out with 80s, and I installed CPM first. I only installed MS-DOS when I sold it before we moved to Hong Kong, because that's what the buyer wanted." At the mention of those early operating systems and a competitor's product, he perked up. "Why didn't you get an Apple II?" he asked. Good question. But seriously, why was I letting this guy interview me? "I never had one," I allowed. "But now that I'm here, I got the Journal to buy me a Fat Mac." I had convinced the big guys in New York that if I was going to be writing about Apple, I'd better be familiar with their latest machines. "I've been using it for a couple of weeks. So far, I do like it better than a PC." I had picked the lock. "Wait till you see what we're going to build here," he told me. "You'll want to get rid of your Fat Mac." We'd finally reached the point of the interview, the destination Steve had wanted all along, the place where he could tell me how he was going to outdo the company he had founded, and best the people, most notably Apple CEO John Sculley, who had effectively banished him from that kingdom. Now he would take my questions, although he didn't always respond to them directly. I was curious, for example, about his eerily empty headquarters. Were they really going to assemble computers here? It sure didn't look like manufacturing space. Was he bankrolling the whole thing? Or was he lining up some investors? He'd sold all his Apple shares, save one, netting him about $70 million. But that wasn't enough to fund a company this ambitious. At times he veered off into completely unexpected terrain. As we talked, he drank steaming hot water from a pint beer glass. He explained that when he ran out of tea one day, it dawned on him that he liked plain old hot water, too. "It's soothing in the very same way," he said. Eventually he would steer the conversation back to his main pitch. Higher education needed better computers, and only Next could deliver them. The company was working closely with both Stanford and Carnegie Mellon, universities with highly respected computer science departments. "They'll be our first customers." Despite his evasiveness and his determination to hew to a single message, Jobs was a vivid presence. The intensity of his self-confidence made me hang on his every word. He spoke in carefully constructed sentences, even when trying to answer an unexpected question. 25 years later, at his memorial service, Steve's widow, Lorene, testified to the fully formed aesthetic he possessed from a very young age. That confidence in his own judgment and taste came through in his answers. It also came through in the fact, as I realized over the course of our conversation, that he really was interviewing me, testing me to see if I grokked, understood, what was special about what he had done and what he planned to do at Next. Later, I came to realize that this was because Steve wanted whatever was written about him and his work to measure up to his own high standard of quality. At this stage of his life, he thought he could probably do anybody's job better than they could. It was an attitude that gnawed at his employees, of course. The interview lasted 45 minutes. The plans he laid out for Next were sketchy. As it turned out, this was an early sign of the troubles the company would experience over the years. There was, however, one tangible thing he did want to discuss: the Next logo. He gave me a fancy brochure explaining the creative evolution of the snazzy corporate symbol Paul Rand had designed. The booklet itself had been designed by Rand personally, with expensive translucent leaves separating thick, creamy pages, embossed with a step-by-step guide to how he had settled upon an image that spoke in multiple visual languages. The logo was a simple cube with Next, uppercase N, lowercase E, uppercase X and T, spelled out in vermilion against cerise and green, and yellow against black. The most intense color contrast possible, and poised at a 28-degree angle, according to the pamphlet. At that time, Rand was noteworthy as one of America's leading graphic designers. He was famous for dreaming up the visual identities of IBM, ABC Television, UPS, and Westinghouse, among others. For this pamphlet, and for a single take-it-or-leave-it draft of a corporate logo, Jobs had happily parted with $100,000 of his money. That extravagance, albeit in the pursuit of perfection, was a quality that would not serve him well at Next. I did not write a story after that first meeting. A fancy logo for an infant company didn't qualify as news, no matter who had commissioned it, no matter who had designed it. Besides, back then the Wall Street Journal never published photographs. In fact, it never printed anything in color. So even if I had wanted to write about Steve's shiny new bauble, its subtle and impractical beauty would have been doubly lost on the journal's readers, who cared little for design at the time. Not writing a feature was the first salvo in the 25-year-long negotiation that marked our relationship. As with most journalist-source relationships, there was one main reason Steve and I wanted to connect. We each had something the other needed. I could deliver the front page of the Wall Street Journal and, later, the cover of Fortune magazine. He had a story that my readers wanted, and that I wanted to tell better and earlier than any other journalist. He usually wanted me to write about a new product of his. My readers wanted to know about him as much as the product, if not more. He wanted to point out all the glories of the product and the genius and beauty of its creation. I wanted to get behind the scenes and to cover the competitive ups and downs of his company. This was the subtext of most of our interactions, a transaction in which we each hoped to cajole the other into some sort of advantageous deal. With Steve, this could be like a card game, where one day I'd feel we were partners playing bridge, and the next I'd feel like a sucker holding eight high in poker. More often than not, he made me feel like he had the edge, whether or not that was true. Despite the fact that the Journal didn't publish anything at the time, Steve told Kathy Cook, a Silicon Valley vet then working for Allison Thomas, that the interview went fine and that he thought I was okay. From time to time, he would have Kathy invite me over to Next for updates. There wasn't much worth covering, frankly, at least in the eyes of the Journal. I didn't write my first big piece about Next until 1988, when Steve finally unveiled the company's first computer workstation. But the visits were always intriguing and invigorating. One time he called me in to crow about persuading Ross Perot to invest $20 million in Next. On the face of it, they were the oddest couple. Perot, the crew cut, buttoned down, uber-patriotic, Navy veteran bankrolling a former hippie who still preferred to go barefoot, was a vegetarian and didn't believe in using deodorant. And yet, I now knew Steve well enough to understand that he and Perot, whom I'd interviewed a few times, were actually kindred spirits. Both were idiosyncratic, idealistic autodidacts. I told him that he absolutely had to visit Perot in his office at Electronic Data Systems, EDS, in Dallas, if for no other reason than to see his over-the-top collection of histrionic eagle sculptures and the colonnade of U.S. flags lining the headquarters driveway. Steve laughed and rolled his eyes in amusement. Been there, done that. He asked if I thought he was crazy for liking Perot. How could anyone not like Perot at least a little after meeting him? I replied. He's funny. Steve cackled in agreement and then added, Seriously, I think there's a lot I can learn from him. Over time, our similar ages became a bridge more than a barrier. Steve and I had navigated similar adolescent rites of passage. I could say the same thing about Bill Gates, whom I also covered extensively. But he wasn't the product of a working-class upbringing or public schools, as Steve and I were. All three of us had dodged the bullet of serving in Vietnam because the military draft was abolished by the time we had turned 18. Yet Steve and I, more than Bill, were true products of the anti-war, peace and love, tune in, turn on generation. We were music nuts and gaga for gadgets, and we weren't afraid to experiment with outlandish new ideas or experiences. Steve had been adopted as a child, and we did occasionally talk about what that had been like. But that aspect of his upbringing never seemed nearly as big an influence on his intellectual and cultural development as was the larger social and political milieu and the high-tech sandbox in which we came of age. In those early years, Steve had an important reason to cultivate our relationship. In the ever-shifting computer world of the late 1980s, building breathless anticipation for his next big thing was crucial to attracting potential customers and investors. And Steve would need plenty of the latter, given that Next would take nearly 5 years to produce a working computer. Throughout his life, Steve had a keen sense of the tactical value of press coverage. This was just one part of what Regis McKenna, perhaps his most important early mentor, calls Steve's natural gift for marketing. Even when he was 22 years old, he had the intuition, McKenna elaborated. He understood what was great about Sony, about Intel. He wanted that kind of image for what he was going to create. Knowing that Apple was also among the companies I covered for the Journal and later for Fortune, Steve would call up at seemingly random moments over the coming years to offer me intelligence that he'd heard from former colleagues who were still there, or simply to share his opinions on the interminable executive soap opera at his old company in Cupertino. Over time, I learned that he was a reliable source about the mess that Apple became in the early 1990s. And I also came to realize that there was nothing random about those calls. Steve always had an ulterior motive. Sometimes he was hoping to glean something about a competitor. Sometimes he had a product he wanted me to check out. Sometimes he wanted to chastise me for something I'd written. In the latter case, he could also play the withholding game. Once, in the late 1990s, after his return to the company he'd co-founded, I sent him a note to say that I thought it was about time for me to write another Apple story for Fortune. I had been out of touch for several months because I'd had open heart surgery. He had called me at the hospital to wish me well. But now I was ready to jump on another piece. His email reply was simple. "Brent," he wrote, "as I recall, you wrote a rather mean story about me and Apple last summer. I remember this hurting my feelings. Why did you write such a nasty story?" But a few months later, he relented and cooperated for another cover feature about the company. Ours was a long, complicated, and mostly rewarding relationship. When I would run into Steve at industry events, he would introduce me as his friend, which was flattering, odd, true, and yet not true, all at the same time. During the brief time when he had an office in Palo Alto near Fortune's bureau, I would run into him around town now and then, and we'd stop to chat about all kinds of things. Once I helped him shop for his wife Lorene's birthday present. I visited his home many times, always for one work reason or another, but with an informality that I've never encountered from another CEO. And yet, there was never a minute where the basic terms of our relationship weren't clear. I was the reporter, he was the source and subject. He enjoyed some of my stories. Others, like the one that prompted that email, infuriated him. My independence and his hoarding of information created the borders of our relationship. This necessary distance expanded during the last few years of his life. Both of us got very sick in the mid-2000s. He was first diagnosed with pancreatic cancer in 2003, while in 2005 I contracted endocarditis and meningitis during a trip to Central America, which put me in a near coma for 14 days and eventually took away almost all my hearing. He knew more about my illness than I knew about his, of course. Still, he did sometimes reveal details. One time we even compared surgical scars, much like Quint, Robert Shaw, and Hooper, Richard Dreyfuss, in the movie Jaws. He visited me in the Stanford Hospital twice during the weeks when I was recovering, stopping by when coming in for regular checkups with his oncologist. He told me some awful jokes about Bill Gates and excoriated me for having continued to smoke cigarettes despite his admonitions over the years. Steve always did love to tell people how to conduct their personal lives. After Steve died, reams of armchair analysis unfurled. Articles, books, movies, and television shows. Often they resurrected old myths about Steve, using stereotypes that had been created way back in the 1980s, when the press discovered the Wunderkind from Cupertino. In those early years, Steve was susceptible to the flattery of the press, and he opened himself and his company to reporters. He was at his most undisciplined and most intemperate then. As much as he showed a genius for imagining breakthrough products, he also could display a disturbing meanness and indifference toward both employees and friends. So when he started limiting access and cooperating with the press only when he needed to promote his products, the tales from those early days at Apple became the conventional wisdom about his personality and thinking. Perhaps that's why the posthumous coverage reflected these stereotypes. Steve was a genius with a flair for design, a shaman whose storytelling power could generate something magical and maleficent called a reality distortion field. He was a pompous jerk who disregarded everyone else in his single-minded pursuit of perfection. He thought he was smarter than anyone else, never listened to advice, and was an unchanging half-genius, half-asshole from birth. None of this jibed with my experience of Steve, who always seemed more complex, more human, more sentimental, and even more intelligent than the man I read about elsewhere. A few months after his death, I started combing through the old notes, tapes, and files from my stories about him. There were all kinds of things I'd forgotten. Off-the-cuff notes I'd written about him, stories he told me during interviews that I couldn't use at the time for one sensitive reason or another, old chains of emails we'd exchanged, even a few tapes I'd never transcribed. There was an audio cassette he'd made for me that was a dubbed copy of one given to him by John Lennon's widow, Yoko Ono, with all the various versions of Strawberry Fields Forever recorded during its lengthy composition process. These were all stored away in my garage, and unearthing them triggered many buried memories of Steve over the years. After rustling through these personal relics from the past for a few weeks, I decided that it wasn't enough to grumble about the one-dimensional myths about Steve that were ossifying in the public mind. I wanted to offer a fuller picture and deeper understanding of the man I had covered so intensely, in a way that hadn't been possible when he was alive. Covering Steve had been fascinating and dramatic. His was a truly Shakespearean tale, full of arrogance, intrigue, and pride, of perceived villains and ham-handed fools, of outrageous luck, good intentions, and unimagined consequences. There were so many ups and so many downs in so short a time that it had been impossible to draw the broad trajectory of his success while he was living. Now I wanted to take the long view of the man I'd covered for so many years, the man who had called himself my friend. The most basic question about Steve's career is this. How could the man who had been such an inconsistent, inconsiderate, rash, and wrong-headed businessman that he was exiled from the company he founded become the venerated CEO who revived Apple and created a whole new set of culture-defining products that transformed the company into the most valuable and admired enterprise on Earth, and that changed the everyday lives of billions of people from all different socioeconomic strata and cultures? The answer wasn't something Steve had ever been all that interested in discussing. While he was an introspective guy, he was not inclined to retrospection. "What's the point in looking back?" he told me in one email. "I'd rather look forward to all the good things to come." A real answer would have to show how he changed, who influenced those changes, and how he applied what he'd learned to the business of making great computing devices. As I pored over my old documents, I kept coming back to the time that many have described as his wilderness years, the dozen years between his first tenure at Apple and his return. That era from 1985 to 1997 is easy to overlook. The lows aren't as dramatic as the blow-ups of his first tenure at Apple, And the highs, of course, aren't as thrilling as those he engineered in the first decade of the 21st century. These were muddled, complicated times, and not the stuff of easy headlines. But those years are in fact the critical ones of his career. That's when he learned most everything that made his later success possible. And that's when he started to temper and channel his behavior. To overlook those years is to fall into the trap of only celebrating success. We can learn as much, if not more, from failure, from promising paths that turn into dead ends. The vision, understanding, patience, and wisdom that informed Steve's last decade were forged in the trials of these intervening years. The failures, stinging reversals, miscommunications, bad judgment calls, emphases on wrong values, the whole Pandora's box of immaturity, were necessary prerequisites to the clarity, moderation, reflection, and steadiness he would display in later years. By the end of that decade in the woods, despite his many missteps, Steve had, remarkably enough, salvaged both Next and Pixar. The legacy of the first secured his professional future, while the triumph of the second ensured his financial well-being. His experience at both companies taught him lessons that, in retrospect, determined the future of Apple and helped define the world we live in. Steve could be intransigent, and nothing was ever learned easily or superficially. But learn he did. Driven and curious, even when things were tough, he was a learning machine during these years, and he took to heart all that he gleaned. No one works in a vacuum. Getting married and beginning a family changed Steve profoundly, in ways that had an enormous positive impact on his work. I had plenty of glimpses into Steve's personal life over the years, and several encounters with Laureen and their children. But I was not a close friend of the family. When I started to report this book, in late 2012, it seemed that I might not learn much more about his personal life. Saddened by his death, and feeling burned by some of what had been published about Steve posthumously, many of his closest colleagues and friends originally refused to talk to me. But that changed over time. And those conversations with his most intimate friends and colleagues, including the only four Apple employees to attend his private burial, revealed a side of Steve that I had sensed but had not fully understood, and that I have certainly never read about elsewhere. Steve was capable of extraordinary compartmentalization. It's a talent that allowed him to master and keep track of the various pieces of an entity as complex as Apple upon his return. It allowed him to maintain his focus despite the cacophony of worries that came with knowing he had cancer. It also allowed him to maintain a deep and meaningful life outside the office, while revealing little of that to people who weren't part of his close inner circle. Of course, he could be a difficult man, even late in his life. For some people, he was hellish to work for. His belief in the value of his mission allowed him to rationalize behavior that many of us might well deplore. But he could also be a loyal friend and an encouraging mentor. He was capable of great kindness and genuine compassion, and he was an attentive and loving father. He believed deeply in the value of what he chose to do with his life, and he hoped those close to him believed in the value of their work just as deeply. For a man who so thoroughly deviated from the mean, as his friend and colleague Ed Catmull, the president of Pixar, puts it, he had deeply human feelings, strengths, and failings. What I have always loved about business journalism and what I have learned from the very best colleagues I've worked with is that there is always a human side to the seemingly calculated world of industry. I knew this was true about Steve when he was alive. No one else I have ever covered was so passionate about the creations of his business. But only in writing this book have I come to understand just how much the personal life and the business life of Steve Jobs overlapped, and just how much the one informed the other. You can't really understand how Steve became our generation's Edison and Ford and Disney and Elvis all rolled into one until you understand this. It's what makes his reinvention such a great tale. At the end of our first interview, Steve walked me down the neat and glimmering hallways of Next's headquarters to the exit. We didn't exchange small talk. As far as he was concerned, our conversation was over. As I exited, he didn't even say goodbye. He just stood there, looking out the glass doors toward the entrance of the parking lot on Deer Creek Road, where a crew of workmen was installing a 3D version of the Next logo. As I drove away, he was lingering there still, staring at his 100 grand logo. He knew in his bones, as he would say, that he was about to do something great. In reality, of course, he had no idea what was ahead of him. Chapter 1. Steve Jobs in the Garden of Allah. On a cold December afternoon in 1979, Steve Jobs pulled into the parking lot of the Garden of Allah, a retreat and conference center on the shoulder of Mount Tamalpais in Marin County, north of San Francisco. He was tired, frustrated, angry, and late. The traffic on 280 and 101 had been at a standstill much of the way up from Cupertino, way down south in Silicon Valley, where the company he'd founded, Apple Computer, had its headquarters, and where he had just suffered through a meeting of Apple's board of directors, which was chaired by the venerable Arthur Rock. He and Rock didn't see eye to eye on much of anything. Rock treated him like a child. Rock loved order. He loved processes. He believed that tech companies grew in certain ways, according to certain rules. And he subscribed to these beliefs because he'd seen them work before, most notably at Intel, the great Santa Clara chipmaker that he had backed early on. Rock was perhaps the most notable tech investor of his time, but he in fact had been reluctant to back Apple at first, largely because he'd found Steve and his partner, Steve Wozniak, unpalatable. He didn't see Apple the way Jobs saw it, as an extraordinary company that would humanize computing, and do so with a defiantly unhierarchical organization. Rock simply viewed it as another investment. Steve found board meetings with Rock enervating, not invigorating. He had looked forward to a long, fast drive to Marin with the top down to get rid of the stale stench of seemingly endless discussion. But the Bay Area was shrouded in mist and rain, so the top stayed up. Slick roads made the traffic stultifying, so much so that it took all the pleasure out of the drive and his brand-new Mercedes-Benz 450 SL. Steve loved the car. He loved it the way he loved his Lynn Sondek audiophile turntable and his Ansel Adams platinum prints. The car, in fact, was a model for what he thought computers should be. Powerful, sleek, intuitive, and efficient. Nothing wasted at all. But this afternoon, the weather and the traffic had defeated the car. Consequently, he was about half an hour late to the initial meeting of the Seva Foundation, a creation of his friend Larry Brilliant, who looked like a little Buddha himself, albeit in track shoes. Seva's goal was pleasingly ambitious: eliminate a certain kind of blindness that affected millions of people in India. Steve parked and got out of the car. At 6 feet tall and a trim 165 pounds, with brown hair that touched his shoulders and deep, penetrating eyes, he would have been striking anywhere. But in the three-piece suit he'd worn to the board meeting, he looked particularly resplendent. Jobs didn't quite know how he felt about the suit. At Apple, people wore whatever they wanted. He often showed up barefoot. The Garden of Allah was a quaint sort of mansion, built on a hillock up Mount Tamalpais, the verdant peak overlooking San Francisco Bay. Nestled into a covey of redwoods and cypress trees, it meshed classic California arts and crafts style with the feel of a Swiss chalet. Built in 1916 for a wealthy Californian by the name of Ralston Love White, it had been operated by the United Church of Christ since 1957 as a retreat and meeting site. Steve walked across the lawn of the heart-shaped driveway, climbed some stairs to a broad veranda, and entered the building. Inside, one look at the crew gathered around the conference table would have told any casual bystander this was not your typical church gathering. On one side of the table was Ram Dass, the Jewish-born Hindu yogi who in 1971 had published one of Steve's favorite books, Be Here Now, a best-selling guide to meditation, yoga, and spiritual seeking. Nearby sat Bob Weir, the Grateful Dead singer and guitarist. The Dead would be performing a benefit for Seva at the Oakland Coliseum on December 26th. Stephen Jones, an epidemiologist from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, was in attendance, as was Nicole Grasset. Brilliant and Jones had worked for Grasset in India and Bangladesh as part of the World Health Organization's audacious and successful program to eradicate smallpox. The counterculture's favorite trickster philosopher, Wavy Gravy, was there too, sitting with his wife near Dr. Govindappa Venkataswamy, the founder of India's Aravind Eye Hospital, which eventually would help millions of people with an operation that repairs blindness caused by cataracts, a malady that then plagued the region. Brilliant was hoping to pull off something almost as audacious as wiping out smallpox. His goal for Seva was that it would support the work of people like Dr. V, as Brilliant called Venkataswamy, by setting up eye camps throughout Southern Asia to restore sight to the blind in poor rural areas. Steve recognized a few of the folks. Robert Friedland, the guy who had convinced him to make a pilgrimage to India in 1974, came up and said hello. And he recognized Weir, of course. He admired the Grateful Dead, even though he thought they didn't have the emotional or intellectual depth of Bob Dylan. Steve had been invited to the gathering by Brilliant, whom he'd first met in India 5 years earlier. After Friedland sent him a 1978 article detailing the success of the smallpox program and talking a bit about Brilliant's next steps, Steve sent Brilliant $5,000 to help get Seva rolling. It was quite a collection of people, Hindus and Buddhists, rockers and doctors, all accomplished, all gathered in the United Church of Christ's Garden of Allah. Clearly, this was not the place for your traditional corporate chieftain, but Steve should have fit right in. He meditated often. He understood the search for spiritual fulfillment. In fact, he had gone to India specifically to learn from Brilliant's guru, Neem Karoli Baba, also known as Maharaj Ji, who had died just a few days before Steve arrived. Jobs felt a deep restlessness to change the world, not just build a mundane business. The iconoclasm, the intersections of different disciplines, the humanity present in that room, all were representative of what Steve aspired to. And yet for some reason he couldn't settle in. There were at least 20 people in the room Steve didn't recognize, and the conversation had not quieted or slowed much when he introduced himself. It seemed to him that many of them didn't even know who he was, which was a little surprising, especially in the Bay Area. Apple was already something of a phenomenon. The company was selling more than 3,000 computers a month, up from around 70 a month at the end of 1977. No computer company had ever blossomed this way, and Steve was sure the next year would be even more explosive. He sat down and started listening. The decision to create a foundation had already been made. The question now on the table was how to tell the world about Seva, its plans, and the men and women who would implement those plans. Steve found most of the ideas embarrassingly naive. The discussion seemed more appropriate for a PTA meeting. At one point, everyone but Steve heatedly debated the finer points of a pamphlet they wanted to create. A pamphlet? That's the best these people could dream up? These so-called experts may have achieved notable progress in their own countries, but here they were clearly out of their league. Having a grand, bold goal was useless if you didn't have the ability to tell a compelling story about how you'd get there. That seemed obvious. As the discussion meandered, Steve found his own attention wandering. He had walked into that room with his persona from the Apple board meeting, Brilliant remembers, but the rules for doing things like conquering blindness or eradicating smallpox are quite different. From time to time, he'd pipe up, but mostly to interject a snide remark about why this or that idea could never fly. He was becoming a nuisance, says Brilliant. Finally, Steve couldn't take it anymore. He stood up. Listen, he said. I'm telling you this as someone who knows a thing or two about marketing. We've sold nearly 100,000 machines at Apple Computer. And when we started, no one knew a thing about us. Seva is in the same position Apple was in a couple of years ago. The difference is you guys don't know diddly about marketing. So if you want to really do something here, if you really want to make a difference in the world and not just putter along like every other nonprofit that people have never heard of, you need to hire this guy named Regis McKenna. He's the king of marketing. I can get him in here if you'd like. You should have the best. Don't settle for second best. The room went silent for a moment. Who is this young man? Venkateswamy whispered to Brilliant. A handful of people started challenging Steve from different sides of the table. He gave as good as he got, turning the group discussion into a Donnybrook, ignoring the fact that these were people who had helped eradicate smallpox from the planet, who were saving the blind of India, who negotiated cross-border treaties so they could perform their good works in multiple, even warring, countries. In other words, these were people who knew a thing or two about getting things done. Steve didn't care about their accomplishments. He was always comfortable in a fight. Challenges, confrontations, in his limited experience, this was how you got things done. This was how the great stuff broke through. As the conversation heated up, Brilliant finally interjected, Steve. And then he yelled, Steve! Steve looked over, clearly irritated by the interruption and anxious to get back to his argument. Steve, said Brilliant, we're really glad you're here, but now you've got to stop it. I'm not going to, he said. You guys asked for my help, and I'm going to give it. You want to know what to do? You need to call Regis McKenna. Let me tell you about Regis McKenna. Steve! Brilliant shouted again. Stop it! But Steve wouldn't. He just had to get his point across. So he took up his argument yet again, pacing back and forth as if he'd purchased the stage with his $5,000 donation, pointing directly at the people he was addressing as if to punctuate his remarks. And as the epidemiologists and the doctors and Bob Weir from the Grateful Dead looked on, Brilliant finally pulled the plug. Steve, he said, sotto voce, trying to remain calm but ultimately losing it, it's time to go. Brilliant walked Steve out of the conference room. 15 minutes later, Friedland slipped outside. He returned quickly and discreetly crept over to Brilliant. You should go see Steve, he whispered in his ear. He's out in the parking lot, crying. He's still here? Brilliant asked. Yeah, and he's crying in the parking lot. Brilliant, who was presiding over the meeting, excused himself and hurriedly walked out to find his young friend, who was hunched over the steering wheel of his Mercedes convertible, sobbing in the middle of the parking lot. The rain had stopped, and the fog had begun to settle in. He had put the top down. Steve, said Brilliant, leaning over the door and giving the 24-year-old a hug. Steve, it's okay. I'm sorry. I'm too wound up, Steve said. I live in two worlds. It's okay. You should come back in. I'm going to leave. I know I was out of order. I just wanted them to listen. It's okay. Come back in. I'm going to go in and apologize. And then I'm going to leave, he said. And that is what he did. This little anecdote from the winter of 1979 is as good a place as any to start the story of how Steve Jobs turned around his life and became the greatest visionary leader of our time. The young man making a hash of his visit to the Garden of Allah that December evening was a mess of contradictions. He was a co-founder of one of the most successful startups ever, but he didn't want to be seen as a businessman. He craved the advice of mentors and yet resented those in power. He dropped acid, walked barefoot, wore scraggly jeans, and liked the idea of living in a commune, yet he also loved nothing more than speeding down the highway in a finely crafted German sports car. He had a vague desire to support good causes, but he hated the inefficiency of most charities. He was impatient as hell, and knew that the only problems worth solving were ones that would take years to tackle. He was a practicing Buddhist and an unrepentant capitalist. He was an overbearing know-it-all, berating people who were wiser and immensely more experienced. And yet he was absolutely right about their fundamental marketing naivete. He could be aggressively rude and then truly contrite. He was intransigent and yet eager to learn. He walked away, and he walked back in to apologize. At the Garden of Allah, he displayed all the brash, ugly behavior that became an entrenched part of the Steve Jobs myth. And he showed a softer side that would go less recognized over the years. To truly understand Steve and the incredible journey he was about to undergo, the full transformation that he would experience over his rich life, you have to recognize, accept, and try to reconcile both sides of the man. He was the leader and public face of the personal computer industry. And yet he was still a kid, just 24 years old, still in the early days of his business education. His greatest strengths were inextricably tied to his greatest weaknesses. As of 1979, those failings had not yet gotten in the way of his success. In the years ahead, however, Steve's tight bundle of contradictions would unravel. His stubborn strengths would give rise to Apple's signature computer, the Macintosh, which would debut in 1984. But his weaknesses would lead to chaos in his company and exile for him personally just 1 year later. They would sabotage his efforts to create a second breakthrough computer at Next, the company he founded shortly after leaving Apple. They would lead him so far from the heart of the computer industry that he would become, in the damning words of one of his closest friends, a has-been. They became so ingrained in his business reputation that when he was improbably invited back to run Apple in 1997, commentators and even industry peers would call the company's board of directors crazy. But then he pulled off one of the greatest business comebacks ever, leading Apple to the creation of a series of amazing products that defined an era and transformed a dying manufacturer of computers into the most valuable and admired company in the world. That turnaround wasn't a random miracle. While away from Apple, Steve Jobs had started to learn how to make the most of his strengths and how to temper somewhat his perilous weaknesses. This reality runs counter to the common myths about Steve. In the popular imagination, he is a tyrant savant with a golden touch for picking products, and equally a stubborn son of a bitch with no friends, no patience, and no morals. He lived and died as he was born, half genius and half asshole. The unformed youth at the Garden of Allah could never have revived the moribund company he returned to in 1997, nor could he have engineered the slow and deeply complicated corporate evolution that led to the unimaginable success Apple enjoyed during the last decade of his life. His own personal growth was equally complicated. I can't think of a businessman who grew and changed and matured more than Steve. Personal change is, of course, incremental. As all grown-ups come to understand, we wrestle with and learn how to manage our gifts and flaws over a lifetime. It's an endless growth process. And yet it's not as if we become wholly different people. Steve is a great object lesson in someone who masterfully improved his ability to make better use of his strengths, and to effectively mitigate those aspects of his personality that got in the way of those strengths. His negative qualities didn't go away, nor were they replaced by new good traits. But he learned how to manage himself, his own personal miasma of talents and rough edges. Most of them, anyway. To understand how that happened, and how that led to the confounding resurgence of Apple later in his career, you have to consider the full range of personal contradictions Steve brought to the Garden of Allah that December afternoon. Stephen Paul Jobs felt deeply entitled almost from the start, thanks to parents who raised him to think that he was every bit as special as they believed he could be. Born on February 24, 1955, in San Francisco, Steve was given up for adoption by his birth mother, Joanna Schiebel, who, as a graduate student at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, had become romantically involved in 1954 with Abdul Fattah Jandali, a Syrian PhD candidate studying political science. Schiebel moved to San Francisco after becoming pregnant, but Jandali remained in Wisconsin. Paul and Clara Jobs, a childless working-class couple, adopted Steve just a few days after his birth. When Steve was 5 years old, they moved to Mountain View, 25 miles south of the city, and soon thereafter adopted a daughter they named Patty. While some have trotted out Steve's adoption as a primal rejection that explains the irascible behavior he often displayed, especially early in his career, Steve repeatedly told me that he had been loved and deeply indulged by Paul and Clara. He felt he had been really blessed by having the two of them as parents, says Lorene Powell Jobs, Steve's widow. Neither Paul nor Clara had attended college, but they did promise Schiebel that they would send their new son. It was a significant pledge for a lower middle-class family, and it marked the beginning of their pattern of giving their only son whatever he needed. Steve was whip-smart. He skipped sixth grade, and his teachers even considered having him skip two grades. After leapfrogging to seventh grade, however, Steve felt snubbed socially and still unchallenged by his schoolwork. He pleaded with his parents to move him into a better school, and they agreed, despite the considerable cost of the switch. Paul and Clara packed up and relocated to Los Altos, a prosperous bedroom community that had sprung up in what were once plum orchards adjoining the low hills, rising to the west above San Francisco Bay. The new neighborhood was then a subdivision within the Cupertino Sunnyvale School District, one of the best in California. Once there, Steve started to flourish. Paul and Clara may have let his sense of entitlement blossom, but they also nurtured his perfectionism, especially when it came to the rigor that underlies great craftsmanship. Paul Jobs held many jobs over his lifetime, including repo man, machinist, and car mechanic. He was at heart an inveterate tinkerer and craftsman who made furniture, or rebuilt cars most weekends, and taught his son the paramount value of taking one's time, paying attention to details, and, since Paul was anything but rich, putting in the legwork to hunt for spare parts that were a good value. He had a workbench out in his garage, Steve once told an interviewer from the Smithsonian Institution. When I was about 5 or 6, he sectioned off a little piece of it and said, "Steve, this is your workbench now." And he gave me some of his smaller tools and showed me how to use a hammer and saw and how to build things. It really was very good for me. He spent a lot of time with me, teaching me how to build things, how to take things apart, put things back together. In his later years, as Steve would show me a new iPod or a new laptop, he would remember how his father told him that you had to devote as much care to the underside of a cabinet as to the finish, or to the brake pads of a Chevy Impala as to the paint job. Steve had a deeply sentimental streak, and it came out when he told these stories about his father. They were made more poignant by the fact that Steve gave his father so much credit for instilling his own sense of aesthetic excellence in a medium, digital electronics, that Paul Jobs would never fully understand. That combination of believing that he was special and of wanting to get things just right, was a potent mix given where and when he was raised.